Well, I'm going to continue talking about QCD today and focusing on the test and the, some of the features and how it describes the strong interactions. A quick review of the basic non-abelian gauge theory is given here. One has 18 types of quarks, that is six flavors, up, down, charm, strange, top, and bottom. And each of those comes in three colors, one, two, and three, or red, green, and blue. And QCD, which describes the strong interactions, only involves the color index. It never changes one type of flavor into another. And in fact, the QCD interactions are the same for all six quarks. There are eight gauge bosons called gluons, and there's a gauge coupling called G sub S for strong. It's also called sometimes G sub 3. And the fine structure constant, the strong fine structure constant, Gs squared over 4 pi. The Lagrangian involves the usual canonical gauge covariant, gauge invariant kinetic energy term for the eight gluons. Unlike QED, unlike U1, the gluons, the structure constants are non-zero, and therefore there are self-interactions, 3 and 4 point interactions, and writing them out in all their glory is truly a mess. The quark part, one sums over the six flavors, and for each there is a gauge covariant kinetic energy term, which includes a coupling to the ith gluon given by the IGSLIGI summed over I from 1 to 8 implied. Where these are the fundamental representation matrices given by lambda over 2. Okay, so now I have written that down and asserted that that describes our world, the strong interactions in our world. But I'd like to say a little about the why we believe that this is the right theory. And at this point, there's not really any doubt about it. But first, let's talk about some of the ingredients of QCD and why we believe them. Well, we started out, first we have the issue of quarks, gluons, and color. Why do we believe in these? Well, the quark model, 1964, was introduced, and it had two roles. One was spectroscopy of hadrons, and secondly, currents. That is, one could explain the whole spectrum of hadrons, baryons, hyperons, kaons, etc., as known at that time, in terms of three quarks, up, down, and strange, with the baryons, hyperons being bound states of three quarks, and mesons, quark, anti-quark. And when I say spectroscopy, I also mean there were many relations between their properties, not just the existence. And the mass spectrum and so forth, the breaking of SU2 and SU3 could be conveniently written in terms of quarks. And furthermore, the Noether currents of SU2 and SU3, as well as weak interaction currents that we'll get to tomorrow, are much more easily written in terms of the quark language than just in terms of elementary protons and pions and so forth. And so this includes all the business of flavor symmetries and breaking. And it nicely encapsulates the approximate SU2 left cross SU2 right chiral symmetry, the strong interactions, its generalization to SU3, the pattern of breaking, the mass splittings, why, etc. However, isolated quarks didn't seem to exist. The electric charges of the quark model in the form that survived. There was an alternative form that never worked out very well with integer charges, but the one that really seemed to work best involved fractional charges in units of the positron charge. And so, of course, after this was postulated, experimenters tried to produce isolated quarks, and it's relatively easy to look for that in anything that measures charge to look for this, also in cosmic ray experiments. And so from 1964 until 2014, no isolated quark has ever been observed. There were a couple hints at one time or another that perhaps there were isolated charges, but they didn't really stand up. So for many people thought that it was just some, that they perhaps didn't really exist. Maybe that this was evidence against a quark model, or perhaps that they were just a mathematical trick, that they didn't really correspond to reality, but somehow just it would be some convenient mathematical artifice to describe hadrons in terms of these. We now understand the reason one doesn't observe them isolated is confinement. There is both quarks and gluons, which carry color, have not been directly observed, and we think we understand within QCD why that is, and I'll come back to that later. I don't want to elaborate now. But we believe that the dynamics of QCD is such that things that actually carry color, like a quark or a gluon, cannot actually be produced as an asymptotic state, only bound states that are colorless. Of course, in the original quark model, they didn't know anything about color. People still talked about confinement, possibly, but we haven't really gotten to putting in the color quantum number yet. Okay, however, things broke in 1970 or so at SLAC. This is the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, which was a 2-mile-long electron accelerator. So one accelerated electrons over a 2-mile path, and then they collided with protons. And what was observed here, one had deep inelastic scattering. And the reaction was an electron plus a proton scattered to make an electron plus X, where this X means hadrons. So they were doing inelastic scattering. A given event might produce a proton and 11 pions, or two protons, an antineutron, K plus, a K minus, and pions. And one actually didn't directly keep track of the hadrons, one just summed over them and just measured the properties of the electron coming out. I don't have time to go into deep inelastic scattering, which was very important historically, also for neutrino scattering later. However, the consequence was that in these reactions, one could apparently describe them by, proton has point-like constituents. What I mean by that is that the cross sections that were measured and their dependence on energy and angle of the electron was completely consistent with that. What was going on was the following Feynman diagram. Here's a photon carrying momentum Q, and it basically seemed like the proton coming in here was actually involved some point-like constituent, and it was, what was happening was that the photon was just scattering off one constituent of the proton, and then there'd be a bunch of hadrons associated with the rest of the constituents, and that this constituent eventually would sort of shower, as we say, or turn into a bunch of hadronic jets. So thinking in terms of this being a quark for now, it means that the final state quark eventually would start radiating pions or creating quark anti-quark. So what you would observe in the end would be just ordinary hadrons. But the guts of the reaction seemed to be just this Feynman diagram, which was in which this acted like a point with no internal structure, no sign of an internal radius, or no form factors, we say, and as if it were just a truly, just as if it were scattering from an electron or something like that. And mathematically, what that meant was it's convenient to describe, introduce capital Q squared, which is minus the four momentum transfer squared. In my metric, little q squared is negative, so this is positive. And for, we're talking about reactions at very large q squared, much larger than, say, the proton mass squared. And the cross-section had been expected. If the proton were just some big fuzzy thing of a radius of Fermi, which we knew it had, one would basically expect that the cross-section would fall very rapidly for large q squared, but it didn't. It stayed big. This was just a Rutherford experiment 60 years later and scaled up in energy by a factor of 1,000. That was, I mean, this, when you first heard about the Rutherford experiment to establish the nucleus as a small point-like constituent of the atom, everything was the same, except the energy scales were a factor of 1,000 smaller. So the protons seem to consist of small, point-like constituents, just like the atom did. Furthermore, so the angular distribution suggested that these constituents had spin a half, not spin zero. The angular distribution of the electron would be very different if this were spin zero versus spin a half. That goes by the name of the Kalman-Gross relation. In the 1970s, one had the first electron-positron colliders, in which electrons and positrons circulating in opposite directions in a circular set of magnets, circular accelerator, could annihilate to produce hadrons. And there were a succession of these machines, both at SLAC in California, at Stanford, and in DAISY, German lab in Hamburg, Germany. And what they were seeing was very similar. They were seeing, I'll draw the Feynman diagram here, with initial at the bottom, photon, and then what they were seeing was consistent, again, with producing a point-like object, so that this would be the same sort of Feynman diagram that you calculated for E plus E minus goes to mu plus mu minus, and the heart of the reaction was here, but then later, much later, the quark, I'll call it the quark, started radiating and turned eventually into a jets of hadrons. And again, the cross-section for large Q squared, if you had just been producing big fuzzy protons and pions It would be hard to make them. It's hard to produce a big fuzzy object with a high energy photon, but it's easy to produce a small point-like object. And so the cross-section was much larger than anybody had expected, and it was very much like the cross-section to produce a pair of muons. And furthermore, this confirmed that they were producing point-like objects. And again, the angular distribution was 1 plus cosine squared theta. Cosine theta is, this is a Feynman diagram. This is a sort of center of mass scattering diagram. And if you think of this as just producing a quark anti-quark, and I should say that that's now the interpretation. That wasn't completely obvious at the time. Theta is just the scattering angle in the center of mass. And that's characteristic of spin 1/2. You would get if it had been a spin 0 constituent that was produced, or spin 0 particle, it would have been a sine squared theta, which I think you calculated yesterday. So here we had, again, evidence that there was these hard point-like constituents. The evidence for the gluon, and by the way, at this point, although people sometimes talked about the possibility that there were the three colors, often one did not make that assumption, and one could, there was still the postulate that there might be gluons, that is some sort of gauge boson of a U1 nature or something that would be mediating the strong interaction. So people talked about gluons both with and without color, but as just a sort of word for the mediation. But by the time we get to the discovery of the gluon a few years later, color had been well established. And let me just draw two higher order diagrams. So this is quark, anti-quark. This is the tree level. And then the leading QCD correction, there are two diagrams. So this is a photon, gluon, quark, anti-quark. And then there's another diagram of the same order in which one actually just radiates a gluon. The gluon was discovered, I didn't look up the year, but it must have been around 1900. It was actually probably not until the 1980s that it was finally announced. But basically, this process was observed because what happened with this was that each of these could start radiating jets of hadrons. And so first, one saw at lower energies two jets, and then as one went to higher energies, there were some events in which this jet looked broader because they couldn't really resolve it as two jets, and then at still higher energies, they could clearly discern that there were three jets being produced. And again, there were angular distributions, et cetera, that established that there was a spin one object being produced. Now let's turn to the NC equals three colors. Why do we think there are three colors, apart from the fact that that fits in with QCD? Well, there was actually a major hint of it from the very beginning. There was an inconsistency with the basic quark model spectroscopy, which I conveniently didn't tell you about when I introduced the quark model. And that was that amongst the quarks, there was a state called the omega minus, which was actually a brilliant prediction of SU3 flavor. This is a spin 3 halves object with strangeness equal to minus 3. And in the quark model, it consists of 3 S quarks. Furthermore, in the details of the model, the spin is singlet. The wave function, you have to include, one has to include the spin and orbital degrees of freedom. And it turns out that this is totally anti-symmetric. It's symmetric. I said it wrong. It's symmetric in spin and pure S wave. That is, all 3 spins are in the same direction. That's why it's spin 3 halves. So it's symmetric in the spin quantum number. Within the details of the spectroscopy, all of the orbital angular momenta of the system are all 0. And so this is totally symmetric wave function in spin and space. But you know that a symmetric wave function for fermions is inconsistent with relativity. That's the spin and statistics theorem. 2 or more fermions always have to be anti-symmetric in their total wave functions. That's why an atom doesn't collapse. And so this was inconsistent. There were other states also that were like this, but this was the most obvious one. So here this omega minus, and I didn't have time to talk about it, but this was actually predicted by SU3, and its mass was predicted correctly, including the SU3 breaking effects. But in the quark, it fits in beautifully with the quark model, but this and the whole rest of the spectroscopy of the baryons require symmetric wave functions. Well, there's an easy solution to that. Add another quantum number in which it's anti-symmetric, because the anti-symmetry refers to the entire state in taking all quantum numbers into account, spin, space, and color. So let's add a color index. And now, in the with color, the wave function, this is this normalization, becomes epsilon alpha beta gamma times S alpha spin up, S beta spin up, S gamma spin up. And that resolves the problem. If you have 3 colors, an extra quantum number, and the physical state is anti-symmetric, then you're fine. You're home free. And in fact, all of the baryon, the spectroscopy for all the baryons could be constructed from anti-symmetric color states. And this idea was floated around from the late 60s, before QCD was actually developed. And it sort of, like many things, it had a confused history. It was called parastatistics at first, but it was really just color. The other evidence comes back to here. I just talked about the Q-squared dependence and the angular dependence establishing some sort of spin 1/2 constituents. But in a little more detail, it's convenient to define a quantity called R of S. S is the square of the center of mass energy. And this is just the ratio of the cross-section to produce hadrons over the corresponding cross-section to produce mu plus mu minus. And it's convenient to work with the ratio, because then all the factors of alpha and 1 over s and pi, you know, and 2 pi over 3 or whatever it is you calculated cancel out. And if this should be just, you think about it, number of colors times the sum over, in the modern language, sum over any quark flavors of QR squared. Because if indeed, and that's this diagram, if this is QR, the only difference, if this is truly point-like, then the only difference of this, and if all the action about the jets, et cetera, happens later, in the asymptotic state so that one doesn't care about it for the guts of the reaction. It just goes like QR squared, like the electric charge squared. I'm using Q both for quark and for electric charge of the quark. I'm sorry. That's sort of clumsy, but Q here means the rth quark, and here I mean the electric charge of that quark. However, if there's, say, three colors for each quark, for up, down, et cetera, then one has to actually sum over the cross sections for those, that is, multiply by nc. And that's the lowest order. Then there are all these higher order corrections, and it's 1 plus alpha strong over pi, and this has been calculated to about fourth order now in alpha. Well, basically, just in words, the observed rate, first of all, the first prediction of the point-like nature is that this should be basically a constant. Whereas, again, if the hadrons had been big fuzzy objects, this would decrease rapidly with S. It's not exactly predicted to be a constant because you have to take into account that if you're at relatively low energies, there's not enough energy to produce, for example, a charm quark. So at low energies, you only would have the up, down, and strange here. And then when you get to higher energies, you have to include the charm, and it's still higher energies, the bottom, etc. So one would expect that this should be approximate, have some steps in it where you get to the masses, like this would be twice the charm mass, twice the m-bottom. And then there's actually some residual energy dependence in these QCD corrections, as I'll talk about later. These are really not constants. They're slowly varying functions. And what is observed is really basically this. What's observed is something like this. The spikes are just bound state effects that near the thresholds, for example, by the at this charm threshold, you can produce states that are called the psi, which is charm, anti-charm, bound state. And here you can produce something called the epsilon, which is a bottom, anti-bottom bound state. At the thresholds, these bound states are, they're described by quarks, but you really can't use this perturbation theory, and so you expect resonant peaks. And those are observed, and that was, in fact, how we really first learned about, experimentally, that the charm quark existed. But that's not my topic now. The point is, one observes these thresholds, one observes the modest S dependence, and the overall scale requires NC approximately 3. So this was probably the definitive evidence for color quantum number. Then, on the theoretical front, QCD developed in the 1970s. I'm going to start talking about short and long distance regimes now. And basically, the strong interactions have the feature that at high energies, they interact very weakly. And at low energies, they become strong. And that has to do with the fact that this alpha S is not a constant. It turns out that QCD is the unique renormalizable field theory that has those properties and which, you know, has the basic features of the strong interactions. In people in the 1970s, by the time they realized all these issues, they did exhaustive searches of every possible renormalizable field theory. Turns out that QCD was the only one that sort of met all the gross requirements of describing the things I've already described. There just wasn't any other possibility. That actually was a big problem in testing QCD. it's easiest to test a theory if you have an alternative theory so that you can compare them. So for example, classical tests of general relativity are expedited by the fact that the Brons-Dickey theory is a generalization, and one can analyze for the extra parameter in the Brons-Dickey theory and see what experimental constraints there are. And if that extra parameter is forced by experiment to be very close to zero, you've got a nice test. But if you don't have a sensible alternative theory, it's a little bit harder to do that. But at any rate, it has asymptotic freedom. And it has infrared slavery. And let me now try to explain what that means, define those things. Well, first of all, recall that in QED, I stated that if you consider, say, electron scattering or any other one photon exchange process, then the tree level is supplemented by loop diagrams involving electrons or muons or heavier particles. There are other types of corrections. And it turns out that at least when the three particles are all on shell, these cancel each other. And this is the important one. There are finite corrections from higher order things, but the thing we're focusing on now is this diagram, as well as the ones in which there are multiple bubbles going across. And that these diagrams give an energy dependence to the or a Q-squared dependence to the cross-section, which basically can be absorbed. These are universal. It doesn't care what's actually out here. It occurs for any photon exchange, whether it's coupling to a proton or to a top quark or to an electron. And one can absorb all these things into some effective interaction in which one pretends that it's just a simple 1 over Q squared propagator. But instead of having a factor of alpha, one has a factor of alpha of Q squared, where again, Q squared is minus Q squared is greater than zero. So in other words, at each vertex, one can conveniently just absorb the effects of these diagrams, sum to all orders, as some effective vertex, and one calls it a running coupling. Now, it's a matter of definition. You could just as well say that E or alpha is a fixed number and that there's some extra energy-dependent stuff. But it's convenient and conventional in the literature to just absorb these things into some effective alpha of Q squared. And the effect of a fermion loop like this is that it's a logarithmic effect. I should write that the diagram would be alpha of Q squared over Q squared rather than just alpha over Q squared when you absorb all those pieces. And it's a logarithmic effect, but basically it causes alpha to increase logarithmically with Q. At very low energies, its value is 1 over 137, and it's somewhat larger. By the time you get to, say, the 100 GeV, it's up to around 1 over 128. There's a sort of hand-waving explanation for why this causes alpha to increase. And that's because it is a screening effect. forget about field theory for a second. Just think about two test charges in a dielectric medium. If you put the two test charges very, very close together, at short distances, they absorb the full electric charge in their Coulomb interaction. But if you start pulling them apart, the dielectric medium in between polarizes in such a way as to screen the charge. And so at large distances, the Coulomb force actually gets weaker than E squared over R. This is just the analog of it, except instead of a dielectric medium, one's creating virtual electron-positron pairs. So the vacuum is like a dielectric medium. Okay, now, the same thing occurs in QCD. Here's a loop of quarks. And so exactly the same, this also screens. And if this were the only thing going on, this would lead to, well, it does lead to some alpha S of Q squared. Again, you can absorb these things into some effective coupling and pretend that it's just a simple propagator here. And if this were the only relevant diagram, then one would have screening and the QCD coupling would increase with momentum. I forgot to make the obvious statement that in any quantum mechanical system, a momentum always scales like 1 over a distance when you do a Fourier transform. So down here, low momentum corresponds to low Q corresponds to large distance where the force is weak, and large Q corresponds to small dimension, small distance where you see the stronger coupling. So you would see the same effect for QCD if that were the only diagram. However, it's not the only diagram. We also have the gluon self interactions. For example, there's a loop like this. I hate the squiggly notation because it's hard to draw. At least it's hard for me to draw. But so here's a four-point interaction, and then it just makes a little loop, and here's two three-point interactions. These two diagrams are also present, and turns out they have the opposite sign. They anti-screen. And there's not really an intuitive explanation for anti-screening. If you wish, the sign is opposite, if you wish, because there's an extra minus sign always in a fermion loop. By the way, the great physicist Landau apparently made a mistake when he first thought about these things in the 50s and forgot about the minus sign. It's hard to believe, but apparently it's true. So these have the opposite sign. In Peskin and Schroeder's field theory text, they try to give some heuristic argument, but I've never really understood those. The main point is you do the calculation of these diagrams, the sign is opposite. And so if these win, and they do for QCD, then the behavior is actually the opposite, and alpha of Q squared actually looks like this. So at large Q squared, well, let's say Q, at large momentum or short distance, it's weak. And at small q or large distance, it gets strong. And in fact, it basically gets very strong at a few hundred MeV. Let's say a GeV or so, gets very strong. And so that's the reason that we have the behavior we have. Namely, at large Q, alpha S is small, and we say quarks act as if they're free. And that's the term asymptotic freedom. They're not, alpha S is not really zero. I mean, one has to do a perturbation theory around it, but in many processes, such as the one I wrote for the E plus E minus annihilation, the first term is, or for the deep inelastic scattering, the first term is independent of alpha S, and then there are corrections, and you can treat them perturbatively. For small q or large r, alpha S is large, and one has things like confinement. I'll hand wave about that just a bit more. And one has strong interactions. We still call these the strong interactions, but it's really a misnomer in this regime. And in fact, one has bound state effects. In this regime, the natural basis of your Hilbert space, if you like, are quarks and gluons. To some extent, you can still use that as a basis in your Hilbert space down here, but for many purposes, it's more convenient to choose a basis involving the bound states, which are much more relevant degrees of freedom. Okay, how does the confinement work? Well, there's no simple analytic proof of confinement. The most quantitative calculations of QCD in this large R region where it's non-perturbative are actually lattice calculations in which one takes space and time and makes them discrete on some, for example, 15 to the fourth lattice. And then one can formulate the QCD equations on that discretized space-time and solve them on a supercomputer. And so the real proof is that those calculations indicate that quarks and gluons, when they get far apart, it's large R, this force becomes so strong that they just can't get out. And only non-colored states can exist as asymptotic states. But the picture, which I already made on the first day, is that if you take a quark and an anti-quark and try to pull them far apart, well, if you take an electron and positron, pull them far apart, then you have electric flux lines that are, you know, the sort that you learn about in freshman physics. But if you do the same thing with QCD, the gluon flux lines basically form into a long, narrow flux tube because of the self-interactions of the gluons with each other. And there's a certain energy density per unit length. And as you pull them further and further apart, you're putting more and more energy in the system. It increases linearly. At some point, you have to put so much energy in that it's more economical to just create a quark-anti-quark pair or an anti-quark-quark pair and break the tube and get two mesons. So that's sort of a hand-waving cartoon of how the confinement works. So colored objects just cannot be isolated. And this is justified in the lattice calculations. Mesons, like the pion, are color singlets. They are have wave functions that are some over alpha 1, 2, and 3, that averages to 0. So this is a singlet under color. And the baryons are like that, like I wrote down earlier for the omega minus, are also color singlets. And these can propagate freely. So that's the picture. And while I'm doing cartoons, how do we get Mr. Yukawa out? Proton, proton, pi, zero, proton, proton. Well, this would be an approximation, and a typical diagram would be something like this. Here's your proton or neutron. Here's your proton or neutron made out of three quarks. And they can exchange a quark-antiquark pair, which are constantly interacting via gluons. That's sort of some limit of the type of diagrams that would, in the appropriate limit, would mimic the Yukawa interaction as some crude approximation valid in that limit. It's the analog of, it's sort of like a dipole-dipole interaction in atomic physics, because a dipole-dipole interaction, or van der Waals, is between two electrically neutral states that nevertheless have internal charges that can polarize. And here these have zero color, but nevertheless the color is, and quarks are ultimately creating an interaction. Questions? So that's sort of the picture of the long distance. Now I'd like to just come back briefly to the short distance, which is where most of the action is today. And let's consider, say, proton-proton scattering at very high energies, such as is observed at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva. So the picture that we have for what's going on in proton-proton scattering, at least in certain high-energy, high-momentum processes, would be that you have proton-proton makes some final state that you observe plus unobserved stuff. And F might be, for example, it might be two jets or three jets, or it might be a weakly interacting particle like a photon, which or it could be a W or two W's. It can be all kinds of things, or it could be a W plus gluon, which makes a jet. All kinds of things. And the basic picture is that what's going on is that your proton comes in, and I'm, here's your other proton, and it decomposes into, it has some constituents. These might be quarks, they might be gluons, and that there is some hard scan, so I'll call this I and J. So I might be a quark, it might be an anti-quark, it might be a gluon, and then there's a bunch of the other parts of the proton just are radiated as jets. And then there is a hard collision in which one makes the final state, which is the thing that is observed. So one might have, for example, QQ, if this is two quarks, might produce QQ, or QQ bar might produce QQ bar, or it might be QQ bar produces gluons, or it might be gluons produce quarks. Anytime you have quark as a final state or a gluon, it'll eventually start radiating. Final state interactions will produce jets of hadrons. But the point is that there is some hard collision in here, which might be one of these things, or it might be QQ bar, might make energetic photon, which makes QQ bar. I mean, there's all sorts of things going on. But the idea is that in certain kinematic regimes in which the relevant momenta are large, you can factorize into something involving the wave functions of the initial protons times a hard collision, which you can treat in QCD by perturbation theory. And then the fragmentation into the jets occurs later and has to be included, but that's basically measured. And one can actually prove in QCD that there is a factorization into the initial state part, the hard collision, and the final state part. A given process might have more than one Feynman diagram. You have, I wrote down diagrams for QQ bar, goes to QQ bar yesterday, and if they have the same flavor, there's actually two diagrams that have to be considered. And you would also have, if you're making a QQ bar, you could also have diagrams in which a gluon just is radiated from the protons. That has to be considered also. At any rate, by now, many, many processes have been calculated and measured in enormous detail at Fermilab near Chicago, and now at the LHC. And it agrees over many, 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 many orders of magnitude with the predictions of QCD. And this factorization into the soft part, well, initial state, hard collision, and final state radiation is also pretty rigorously justified. So this is why we really believe in the QCD. I want to emphasize that not all collisions are of this hard part where there's a something carrying a very large momentum. There are also collisions in which all the momentum involved, you might have high energy for your protons, but in which you don't have any large momentum here. And in those collisions, it's this messy regime where it's all the messy, complicated, strong interactions. Are there any questions? By the way, the reason I'm hand-waving so much here is that most of these calculations, for example, just the technology of describing this in any detail is something that would take a full one semester course to get into, to go beyond just the hand-waving pictures. It's very, very complicated technology. And people who are not specializing in QCD generally, and I don't, by the way, even I find it, those discussions almost impenetrable sometimes. They're just so detailed and so technical. Okay, in the last few minutes, I want to return to this running of couplings and just write down the equations in a little more detail. And these are called the renormalization group equations. And here, the term group, the group involved is very, very different character from the ones we've been doing. It's not really a symmetry group, internal symmetry. It refers to relating things at different scales. But all I want to do here is write down, for a general gauge theory, so in an arbitrary gauge theory, let's suppose I have an arbitrary gauge group, but just a simple group like SU3 or SO10 or something, and with some gauge coupling G. Well, it turns out that just by calculating those all of the diagrams here, where this can include fermions, gauge bosons, and scalars, complex or real scalars, if they are part of the theory, then you have to calculate all these bubble diagrams. And the net result is that dg squared, d log of q squared, everything goes logarithmically with the momentum. And so g squared is at q squared, like in the diagrams I've written there. Turns out that this is 4 pi times something called the beta function. And this beta function, which is a function of g squared, not q squared, I'm sorry, turns out that this is can be expanded as g to the 4 plus order g to the 6. This is the one loop effect, and this is two loops. And then you can go higher. For QCD, it's been calculated, I think, to 4 loops. And you see, the g to 4, I mean, we're talking about a correction to the g squared, and the lowest order loop itself has a g squared in it, so altogether it's g to the 4. And this b can be written, I'm only going to write the one loop part. It's minus 11/3 times the quadratic Casimir operator for the group. The quadratic Casimir operator for the group is the same thing as the Dinkin index for the adjoint. And this is negative, and this is the result of the gauge loops. And then there's a positive piece from fermion loops, and then there's a piece from the complex scalars. This means complex. And then there's a piece from the Hermitian scalars, real, if they are part of the theory. See, and I'll define all these things. So C2G is just the Dinkin index for the adjoint representation of the group, and it is equal to M for SUM, and it's 0 for U1. And I have a table in my book of the other simple groups. T fermion times delta, Kronecker delta ij, is just the trace of Li fermion, Lj fermion, which we know is the Dinkin index for the fermion representation times delta ij. This is for a non-chiral. If we have a, for a chiral symmetry, it's just the one half of the trace of the fermion representation for the left-handed fermions. This is J, plus one half trace L right, I L right, J. And this reduces to that if L left is equal to L right is equal to L psi. So it's basically just T is basically the Dinkin index. And the for the Hermitian and for the complex scalars, it's just the Dinkin indices associated with their representations. I don't want to write that. QCD doesn't have any elementary scalars. But the main point is that if you look at the sign of that, if you had, now let's put everything on a log scale, and I should, if you put everything on a log scale, you can see that for beta positive, the alpha increases, like in QED, whereas for negative beta, it decreases. And asymptotic freedom requires a negative beta. The only negative term is the one associated with the gauge bosons. In fact, that's part of the statement that QCD is unique. Only non-abelian gauge theories can have a negative beta function. And asymptotic freedom was understood, and people understood everything up here and just tried to examine all the theories. And then finally, I'm almost done. Finally, Gross and Wilczek showed that the non-abelian gauge theories had the negative beta. Okay, in fact, you can, if you want to start on that side. Okay, so now just to complete this, let me just work to one loop. It's trivial to integrate the differential equation at one loop to get an analytic solution. And one finds that 1 over alpha of Q squared is equal to 1 over alpha at some reference scale, I'll call it M, minus 4 pi b log Q squared over M squared. Or if I specialize to QCD, I have within sub Q flavors, I have to sum over all the representations. So there's there in the beta function, have add in each representation. I get 1 over alpha S Q squared is equal to sum 1 over alpha S M squared plus 33 minus twice the number of quark flavors over 12 pi log Q squared over M squared. And so we see for NQ less than or equal to 16, one has asymptotic freedom. And certainly for NQ equals 6, we do. Finally, because I've run out of time, I will simply say that alpha S gets big if eventually, eventually, alpha S gets very big, and it gets big at some scale lambda, which is just defined as the scale it gets big at, and that's about 200 to 300 MeV. And this sets the strong interaction scale. It's the scale at which everything gets strong, and that actually sets most of the proton masses associated with these strong interaction effects and not the up and down quark masses. So the strong interactions become very strong at this scale. A GeV is fine, but I mean, roughly, that's the picture. Are there any final questions? Okay, I'm going to tomorrow I will start talking about the weak interactions, and I will first describe the Fermi theory and then go on to the standard model. Tomorrow will only be the Fermi theory. If you're interested in a historical discussion, which is interesting, I put some notes from another lecture series on the, it's actually on the wiki now, as well as my own web page, and you might want to look at that, but that's optional. Okay, I'll see you tomorrow.